Hello, I'm Russell Rowland, author of 56 Counties, A Montana Journey. Welcome to 56 Counties. So I'm really happy to welcome Tim Gordon, who is a world-renowned appraiser of incredible art and other stuff, just in a wide variety of really interesting projects that you've worked on through the years. And we'll get to that in a minute. But first, I just wanted to ask you about, you grew up in Missoula and your dad had a construction company there, right?
Yeah, that's kind of how I started out. As a kid, though, I was early on, I was interested in this career, but I had to find that out later on. So I began doing this when I was about 10 years old, and yet I worked construction for a bit and delivered pizzas, and you know what you do when you're under 20. But around 20, this just took over. It became an all-consuming passion. Yeah.
So it sounded like your mother was really involved in the arts, and so did she sort of pass that interest along to you and encourage your interest in the arts?
I owe it all to my mom. Yeah, no, she was awesome. You know, she grew up in Oilmont, Montana, and grew up in a tar paper shack. Hated wind and bugs and everything lowly from then on out. Even though she's a very a humble person, but that kind of, she had a mother who was very artistic, and that kind of went over into my mom's life. And so I'd wake up in the morning when I was a kid, Russell, and I'd hear her playing Chopin, and I'd go down into the kitchen. There'd be a wet oil painting hanging there. And then she was always going to write the great American novel, which I think her background was interesting enough that she probably could have done it from her life up in Oilmont and around Montana, But she had a major influence in my life.
Is she still alive?
No, she passed some time ago.
Okay.
Yeah. But I don't know, the stories she would tell me when I was a kid of up in the oil field. You know, her dad eventually struck oil. And so, he was an Irishman who was kind of a wildcatter up there in those days. And he struck oil one night, and she was in her tar paper shack and woke up the next day. And he had, in a drunken amount of zeal, he had purchased a bankrupt circus. And so it's surrounding this tar paper shack were circus wagons and animals, etc. So
that's interesting.
Yeah, stories like that, I think she could have written that great American novel.
Yeah. So did she live long enough to see you become the success you are? And I bet that was thrilling for her.
She did. She died long enough ago that she didn't see me on the Antiques Roadshow, but I had done other television work prior to that. Mm-hmm. And so she approved of my passion and she applauded my success. I think one of the projects I did that she was able to watch me get excited about and take on was the federal government asked me to appraise the historic contents of Yellowstone National Park. And she...
Wow.
And I thought that was pretty grand, so yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. That must have been so cool.
Yeah.
So tell me about how you found your way to this particular career, because there's really no kind of training or schooling for what you do.
That's exactly right. A lot of people will come to me and they'll ask about becoming an appraiser, and the way you become an appraiser, you can't really take classes, even though courses are offered, etc. To become an appraiser who's knowledgeable and gets it, you have to have held hundreds of thousands of things or tens of thousands of things and understood what they were and understood the value of them. That all began in my life when I was a kid. I referenced it earlier. I actually was an antique dealer when I was in my, let's say, 10 to 18 is when I was really flying high. I would go to antique shows and set up tables and sell things. Then what happened is I started dealing in Western Americana and Western art, and I was doing that in my early 20s, and I kind of became a little bit of a big shot, in that field. And so people knew my name and they would call for advice. And then that led into me walking away from construction and delivering pizzas and becoming an art appraiser and an antique appraiser. So the business, it developed as I learned and held those tens of thousands of objects as a teenager. And I found them, I examined them, I researched them, and then I sold them. And so
wow.
That's how I became an expert. Yeah.
So it's just a process of learning by on the job. When did you realize that you could actually make a living at it? It sounds like that was pretty early.
Yeah, well, you know, it was early, and that life was kind of cool about it is if you love old things, you love the surroundings of the history and the regionalism of them. And so while I was a young antique dealer, I discovered Virginia City, Montana. And so, you know, down there, I started leasing from the Bovey families and doing businesses down there, which is, you know, I had an antique store and I had an old fashioned photo studio. And later on, even went on to be the producer of the theater there, et cetera. So it's a life in the past is pretty much. I've lived in places that were from the past, and I've always dealt in things from the past, dead people's things.
Right. So one of the interesting things about some of the collections that you've been brought into to appraise is that there's really nothing you can compare them to. So, I mean, that must present a real challenge. Like, I'm thinking of Princess Diana's gowns.
Yeah.
What do you compare those to? Or Jim Morrison's estate, which I just love that story that you actually had access to the unpublished works of Jim Morrison. That must have been so amazing.
Yeah. Well, let's take both of those people. And so to get the comparable values to show what they were worth, what their value was, you need to compare them to like things that have sold in the market.
Okay.
And so what I did with, for instance, with Jim Morrison. So, you know, I was on Antiques Roadshow one day and I was interviewing Jim Morrison's college roommate. And then the next week his family called me and they go, well, we have a dilemma and we're interested in talking to you about engaging with you to do a project on on Jim Morrison's writings. And with these, poor Jim, you know, when he died in a bathtub in Paris at 27, joined the 27 Club.
Right.
He'd given up the Doors. You know, he wasn't doing music, except for he was writing poetry and writing lyrics voraciously. And so he walked around Paris. He had this big collection in a portmanteau, you know, folder that he would carry his writings and just, he would sit in the Parisian cafes and write all day long to where he built up quite a large selection of writings that were very important. You know, he's probably one of the most interesting and talented people of his generation and one hell of a poet. Anyway, he died and he had a common law marriage with Pamela Corson. And so Pamela had these writings and she went to one of his fellow poets who he'd been kind of studying with, Michael McClure. And she goes, Michael, would you help me to edit these writings into, you know, publishable form, get them out to the world, get the songs out to the world? And Michael advised her, he goes, you know, you're around not good people. You have friends who are drug addicts. Mm-hmm. Somebody's going to steal all this. And Michael, these are his words. He said, I want you to put that writing in a vault and I'll help you when I get time. And then he said, sadly, that's what she did because she overdosed of heroin that next year.
Right.
So anyway, the family called me after I'm on roadshow with Jim's college roommate, and they wanted me to meet them in California to be the first one to crack that vault of writings open. And what they wanted to do is they hadn't really had access to it prior to about 8 years ago. And so they wanted me to go in and evaluate it, and then they wanted to give it to the world to bring out Jim's writings and his poetry and his song that he had died on. And so I did that. For a year, I went in, I dove into these thousands of pages. And so I had Jim Morrison in my head. Nobody else had all these songs and writings for about a year. And then the beautiful thing is it finally came out and Jim's legacy begins now because it was just published by Harper in London.
Just recently?
Yeah, two years ago. Yeah.
Okay.
So anyway, it was nice to be in on like Jim's grave was one of the most, it was the most visited grave on earth at Pierre Lachaise. And I remember being a dumb kid around 20 and wandering around the cemetery looking at Chopin's grave and Sarah Bernhardt and, you know, all these famous people's graves. And then all of a sudden I stumbled on Jim's grave.
Wow.
And I had somebody take a picture of me standing at his grave when I was 20 years old. And who would have thought that I would figure into his life, you know?
That is crazy. So they were in that vault for decades.
Yeah. From 1972-ish through when I showed up.
It's amazing. So talk about Princess Diana.
Yeah. Oh my God. You know, so Missoula kid, Missoula used to be a blue collar town. It wasn't all hoity-toity like it is now. So I applied my trade here and I got a reputation. And then one day I was contacted to fly over to London. It was shortly after Diana had passed. And so I get up to go to Kensington Palace to appraise her royal gowns. She's the most famous princess of 500 years, you know?
Yeah.
And so here's what's going through my mind. You know, I'm wearing a suit and sneakers as I walk through the grounds. You remember the photos right after she was died in the car wreck? It was heaped with bouquets from tens of thousands of mourners, you know? And I just, as I was walking across the lawn, that's what came to mind. And then I went into the palace and I began the work of evaluating these priceless treasures, gowns made by the world's best designer of sometimes of gem-like quality, woven fabrics. They're like famous dresses, like you would see her dancing with John Travolta at a ball at Kensington or something, you know. And anyway, that was quite a job for a kid from Montana to get that job. That was transformational for me.
So how many were there?
Going back in my mind, I think that it was the main display at Kensington Palace. And so I believe there were around 30. Yeah. So what that work looked like was to, go in and inspect the material, make a report on the conditions. I actually even did black lighting. It was kind of cool. I blacklit one of her velvet dresses, and on the knees, I could see these little grubby fingerprints from one of her two kids, you know?
Oh.
Yeah.
Hilarious.
But it was work to, you know, to record what was there and then get the value. And what I did to compare Diana's dresses, I compared her to Marilyn Monroe, Grace Kelly, Princess Margaret, Wallace Simpson, other famous women's dresses. And then I even did a Survey Monkey where I went into the market and I had people who were historians and auctioneers and experts in textiles, et cetera, look at my criteria on these women. And then, you know, I'm getting really involved here on how I did the scale of comparable values. But
but
it turned out that, so I looked at sex appeal, fame, royalty, other factors, and she topped the list. She was above Marilyn. Well, Marilyn, you know, they had sold a Marilyn dress for a few million dollars. And so that's where I got my comparables.
Mm. So what happened to them? Do you know?
I believe that they were the ones that were at the palace, they remained at the palace. And then these were privately owned when I appraised them. And so that person dispersed that collection. But they were on display at Kensington for, I believe, 3 or 4 years as the main show. Don't quote me, but I think it was about that long, yeah.
So another interesting project you did was Al Capone's.
Yeah. Poor Geraldo. You know, he did that big wind-up TV show. It was about 6 hours long. He went to look in Al Capone's vault, and all he found was an empty whiskey bottle. Well, I got a call from Al Capone's granddaughters, and obviously they'd had to change their last name over their life, and they both ended up out in California. They knew Al after he got out of Alcatraz. He paid his debt to society, so they thought of him as a loving grandfather, which he he actually, I think those interactions were loving, you know. I'm not going to make any qualifications on his character, but, you know, he had his good and bad days, we'll say. Well, what was neat is, sometimes I have a little confidentiality about why they called me in. But so I spent 3 or 4 days with his granddaughters foraging through their house. And I found things such as Al Capone's Patek Philippe watch with diamonds that said AC on the exterior. I found his pistol. All of his furniture was there. All of his photo albums of his associates were there. One interesting thing I did find in the basement, I located a film that Al had taken on his yacht. So he's sitting there, he's holding the camera on his yacht, and he's looking at these, you know, there's a wake going beyond this Chris Craft yacht that he had. And by the motor in the back, there are two really handsome Italian guys there. And one looks like a young Dean Martin, and the other one is a little bit more distinguished. And, you know, he's a very handsome guy. And the more I looked at him, I go, who are those guys? And it turned out I was looking at Lucky Luciano and Frank Costello. You know, Frank Costello is who they patterned Marlon Brando's figure, you know, Corleone after in The Godfather. Right. So I think that film was pretty much, those guys weren't supposed to be together at that time. And I think that might have been the start of things in America, you know, shady dealings that were more connected than not. But right. I don't know.
So do you get kind of a chill like when you're holding Al Capone's pistol? I mean, that must have been so like overwhelming in a way.
This sounds really, it sounds like it's too much, but it's real. The minute you touch something like that, you almost get an electrical connection.
I can imagine.
Yeah, the history of what that object was connected with, it jolts you, and I run into that all the time. You know, I've held incredible treasures. A couple of years ago, I was holding Davy Crockett's Bowie knife, Jean Lafitte's pirate sword. I've held Marie Antoinette's gowns. George Washington letters. That's the beauty of my job is I ain't playing, but I get to play with really fabulous treasures.
Yeah.
Real treasures. Yeah.
Talk about like maybe some of the real surprise treasures that you found, like when you're asked to do an appraisal and somebody doesn't realize that they have something incredibly valuable.
Yeah. And, you know, that lack of realization has many scales. I mean, sometimes it's somebody who they are a collector themselves and they just can't even fathom that they have the amount of what they have and what the objects that they do at the level that they're admired by the world. Well, let's see, we'll go close to home here. You know, I'll give you a couple of examples if you wish here in Montana.
Yeah.
Just to let everybody in Montana know that, you know, this place has its rich, rich heritage with its wonderful treasures. But, you know, one day I got a call from the heir to the Bovey family, Ford Bovey, and his mother had passed away. And so Ford asked if I would run out to the ranch east of Malmstrom. About 10 miles out, it's called Sunnydale Ranch. And that was Charlie Bovey's ranch. And I go, what am I looking at for it? He goes, well, my mom passed away and she had kind of a deal on a merry-go-round we have out there. So I go, okay. And it's January. So I drive all the way from Missoula along the icy highways. And I get out to this ranch with all the cut stubble on the field of the wheat, you know, and snow on top of it. I drive over a rise and I look and the building is about the size of a football field that contains this quote merry-go-round. And I go in, I enter the door and it's freezing. You can see your own breath and ice crystals floating in the air. And when my eyes adjusted to the room, I looked up about 40 feet and there was a stained glass pavilion building called the Eden Pavilion. And inside of that was an 1883, a Belgian-made carousel that ran on railroad tracks. And it wasn't a carousel for kids. It was a carousel for drunken Parisians. And so on the interior of this building, this hexagonal building, which had giant stained glass butterflies housing it, and at the ticket booth, there were carved centurions that went up 16 feet. And anyway, you go inside, and there was a champagne bar in every one of the corners of the hex. And you didn't ride horses. You got in with your friends or your paramours, and you rode in screened-in coaches and drank champagne all night. And so in the center were full nude carved women in wood, you know, not to be too purient here, but it was quite the den of iniquity. It was more of Dracula's carousel than just a merry-go-round, you know. But, you know, a very valuable thing, a giant work of art. It was covered in oil paintings. The craftsmen who carved the wood were the best in Europe at the time. Yeah. And Charlie Bovee had bought this at Candy Mountain in Colorado in the 1940s and had transported it up to Great Falls area to his ranch. And he had never really shown it to the public. He just didn't get that far. Yeah.
Wow.
So again, I was kind of first on the scene after things sat for a while, but you could almost hear the drips of the champagne out of the empty bottles inside, you know, so.
So is it in pretty good condition still?
You know, it was in great, it was a good barn find condition, we'll say. That's a term that maybe you guys have heard, but the deal went through. And so it was purchased by Jasper Sanfilippo in Chicago. And I know that before he passed away, he put seven figures into restoring it, which, you know, he redid the oil paintings, et cetera. But that just shows you the extreme value of it. You know, it alone was worth restoring at that monetary.
So did he set it up for use?
Yeah, had it in his private collection. He's a coin op collector, they call it. You know, people who collect, you know, Wurlitzers and Nickelodeons and merry-go-rounds and things. But he had it in Chicago, and then I hear now you can go in and you can actually, if you're invited, I think it's an invitation-only thing, you can go in and see it and actually see it in operation, yes. I have not been there yet, yeah.
Oh, you should do that.
I know, I have to.
Yeah.
Go see an old friend, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So aside from appraising, you also represent people who are trying to sell items. How much of your business, what's the split there as far as appraising or representing or?
Yeah. Well, that's a really super important part of my work for other people and for my business. I'd say it's probably 50-50. You know, if you get something appraised, you know, sometimes that appraisal is for insurance, but a lot of times it's for, you know, it can be an estate situation. It can be, you know, there's just a change of life and we would like to finally sell this treasure we've had all these years. I've been lucky enough to, I have an international reach. And so I've had works of art, like, you know, for instance, I helped a client to market a painting. And it ended up in the National Gallery between next to two Vermeers. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
So I'm able to, and then, you know, I referenced earlier, you know, like the Davy Crockett Bowie knife and things. That was a sales situation, you know. And so anyway, yeah, I do help people with those treasures to find the market. But what's interesting and what's most important is you just can't, you know, put a painting that is now in the Smithsonian on Facebook Marketplace. You have to know somebody who knows the very best avenues to market your work. And that could be either private sale or, you know, auctioneers, there's all kinds of auctioneers. So you want to pick the right auction house. Like, you know, a Charlie Russell painting is going to sell better in Great Falls, Montana than it is in Louisiana. And so what's nice is throughout my career, my lifelong career, I've made associations with many of the principals in the major auction houses in the world. So I know how to get things to where they should go.
Sure. Why don't you tell me about the checks and balances that are in place to prevent appraisers from overvaluing items just for a big commission?
Yeah, you know, appraisers, if you are a trained professional appraiser, there are ethics involved. And so the Appraisal Foundation of America has what's called the USPAP report writing standard. And So it's written according to guidelines as defined by that organization. And what that means, in essence, you know, not to get too technical, it's like your comparable values are going to help you to dictate quite a lot the value of an item. And I always, you know, what you do is you go to comparable sales of like items, and within the current marketplace, within the current location. And so that just, you know, there's guardrails and there's boundaries, and it's a time-honored profession, and a good appraiser is always bound by ethics. And so that's how I comport myself.
So how often have you been on the Antiques Roadshow, and did that help your business, or were you pretty well established already by then?
Well, what's really nice about it is I had a good, strong, flourishing career, but you know, I was to get on that show, you don't just send a nice photo of yourself smiling and say, I'd like to be on there. I was invited to be on there, and generally how, you know, I'm not sure how their practices work exactly, but it's just through recommendation by your peers. You're acknowledged as somebody who's kind of made a mark in your field of the industry of appraisal, and then asked to be an invited appraiser. And so it's quite an honor. Yeah. I think I did my first show in Rapid City, South Dakota in 2012. And then, you know, we get all the way up into around 2019, and COVID hit, and the whole world just kind of slowed down. And about then I was no longer with Roadshow. I backed away and have been working on other projects ever since. Yes.
Uh-huh. Right. So what events do you have coming up? I know you're coming to Billings for an event at the Yellowstone Art Museum.
Yeah, that's going to be really fun to come into Billings. Another Antique Roadshow appraiser, Grant Zahiko, he is donating his time, along with me donating my time, to the Yellowstone Art Museum for the Foundation for Montana History. Yep. Yeah, so Friday, May 9th, people can come in and bring objects. And if you've ever thought you had that real rare world-shaking object and wanted to bring it to an appraisal event, Grant and I will look at it. We're asking for a $20 donation per object to the organizations. We're donating our time. What's fun is, you know, Billings probably has a lot of treasures there. I'm a Montana history nut, and I know that there's wonderful Montana history, but you know, people have traveled the world and ended up in Montana, or they're from Montana, traveled the world and come back with treasures. And so if you just have something you want to know what it's for, or just a little bit about it, then we are there to supply that for you in an appraisal or a verbal evaluation form. It's not a official appraisal. It's a verbal evaluation for entertainment purposes only. Yeah, we don't have a lot of time to research out the objects. We're using our life's knowledge, and I know Grant probably has a few decades under his belt, as I do, in evaluating and looking at rare items. That's what we do all of our life.
Where can people go if they're interested in contacting you about your services?
Yeah, you know, I'm a Montanan and I'm here in Montana, but if you want to reach out to me, I have a good website. It's gappraisals.com. So feel free to reach out if you're curious about, you know, something of value that you want to know more about it, and I'd be happy to respond back to you.
All right, Tim, thank you so much, and I look forward to meeting you when you're here in Billings.
Me too, Russell. I'm really looking forward to meeting you. Thank you so much.
Thanks to Tim Gordon, world-renowned appraiser, and you can meet him at the Yellowstone Art Museum Friday, May 9th. Thanks for joining me on 56 Counties.